Welcome to Topical Talks with Title Research. My name is Anthony Alsop and I'm Head of Business here. Today I'm pleased to be joined by my colleague and Head of Service Delivery, Charlotte Toogood, as well as today's expert guest, Andrew Wilkinson of Shakespeare Martineau. For those of you who are listening to your first episode, Topical Talks is a podcast brought to you by Genealogical Research and Asset Repatriation Specialist Title Research. In each episode, we speak to a highly regarded legal profession about their area of expertise and views on current popular topics of conversation. So let me give you a brief introduction to today's guest, Andrew Wilkinson from Shakespeare Martineau. He frequently acts as an independent trustee, executor or administrator, often in high value and complex estates involving disputed aspects. He has a wealth of experience acting for both individuals and charities in resolving disputes regarding legacies, wills, trusts, estates and powers of attorney. He's an experienced litigator, both in the High Court and Court of Protection, and is well versed in mediation and other alternative dispute resolution. He's also a regular contributor to the Financial Times and has contributed to many other publications for several years. Welcome, Andrew. Pleasure to have you, and welcome, Charlotte.
Thank you, Anthony.
Thanks, Anthony. Nice to be here.
Andrew, so I was just thinking it might be a good place to start is perhaps you could tell us a little bit of background about yourself and how you've ended up in the role that you're in now, really.
Yeah, so I started off as a litigator back when I qualified in, oh, too long ago, 2006 now. I trained at a regional firm in Leicester, which was known as Harvey Ingram, and which essentially has become the firm that I now work for, which is Shakespeare Martineau. I qualified as a commercial litigator, and then was doing that for a few years. Quite enjoyed it, but was starting to get a bit bored with it. And then the recession hit in 2008, and the work that I was doing at the time, for various reasons, fell off a cliff. And I was looking for something that was kind of more interesting, that was going to, also ultimately give me a career, but also had that sort of human interest. And that's when I kind of came to contentious probate, so will disputes, essentially. We had a strong private client team at the time. We had a strong litigation team, and really it was the obvious gap in terms of what we were doing for clients. So really it went from there. I started off doing, a little bit of that sort of work, and then I did the ACTAPS course, the Association of Contentious Trust and Probate Specialist course, and then it's kind of gone from there, really. So obviously my own practice has developed, and I've now got a team around me. So we've now got a team of 8 people working across all of our offices doing contentious trust and probate, and it's an area that kind of continues to grow. As I said, the firm that I was at originally, Harvey Ingram, was merged. There was a number of mergers, and it ended up as Shakespeare Martineau, which it is now. And that firm is going to, I think will continue to grow. And contentious probate is a big part of that, really. So it's been quite a roller coaster, but it's been one that's been, great, and it's been very successful. So it's
sounds very interesting.
Yeah.
So we're nearly a year into the COVID-19 pandemic. What impact have you seen on, well, your firm and any other private client practitioners? Has there any impact sort of come to light as of yet?
I think it's been hugely challenging in lots of different ways. I think obviously initially it was just that transition to home working. I think, without wanting to offend people, private client lawyers tend to be a little bit slower to converting to sort of paperless ways of working. And I think, again, I could, this could get me in trouble, but I think there is some reluctance, and I think that part of that job is very paper heavy, but I don't think that it's always as paper heavy as it needs to be. So I think initially a lot of it was that adjustment very quickly to home working, and the challenges that faced from a practical point of view. From the litigation side of things, I think it was a bit of a different story. We already worked paperless anyway. My team worked across all the offices, so inevitably that meant that we weren't relying on physical files, for example. So I think it meant that probably for us the transition was a bit smoother. Obviously, it wasn't easy. It took time, but I think it was less of a change than it might have been for some other teams in the firm. I think initially, in terms of work, clients in particular, I think, weren't focusing on us, on their lawyers and the disputes that we were dealing with, or their private client, you know, the other things that we were helping them with. I think it was much more about kind of surviving. It was homeschooling. It was kind of dealing with all those practical stuff that people were dealing with. I think there was sort of time went on and people were spending more and more time at home. I think actually people actually had more time to think about some of these things. And certainly we found that with a lot of the litigation work that we did, where obviously a lot of our clients are just individuals at home, that actually they were more focused on trying to get things sorted than they had more time ultimately to deal with those things than they did before. And the court system got pretty good fairly quickly at working remotely. So we had remote hearings, which again were working pretty well, and also remote mediations as well, which we've done quite a few of now, and which again have worked really well. So I think there was definitely a sort of transition and moving to these new ways of working, but I think actually it worked pretty smoothly for us. And actually I think now, in terms of the team, I think we're working much better as a team across multiple areas, and actually it doesn't really matter where we are.
Yeah, and I think a lot of businesses, they've had to adapt, haven't they? But they've obviously had to put the client's needs at the forefront and actually make sure the business is working for their employees, but for their staff as well. Obviously, yeah. With the COVID pandemic, obviously the new legislation has been brought in surrounding the witnessing of documents via the video conferencing software. Obviously, the amendments to the Wills Act. What are your thoughts on that initially?
When it initially came in, I think we all thought, well, I think I thought that this looks like a positive change. This is, you know, this is finally some sort of move towards, you know, 21st century, you know, kind of approaches to these documents, and we're sort of updating the legislation. I think, however, on sort of further analysis, actually, it might be good for the litigators in the sense that I think there is potential for there to be disputes. But I think in terms of clients, you know, our advice remains that it is absolutely a last, you know, it should be the fallback option. You know, if you can do a will in the normal, in inverted commas, way, then you absolutely should. There are so many, it's so easy to get wrong. And I think it's fraught with difficulties.
Yeah, from my understanding, I think one concern that I've had, obviously, in terms of reading it, is a bit, obviously, once your individual, they've signed their will over the video conference with their two witnesses, that time lag then between the actual witnesses physically signing that document, and especially in your area, potential if a witness passes away before it gets there. I could just see the contentious side potentially from it, the work just increasing just due to that actual, the process really.
Yeah, I agree. And I also think as well, there's also this sort of confidentiality issue, which is that, you know, normally when you witness a will, you just give them the document and they just read the, you know, the bottom bit where it just has the bit for their signatures.
Yeah.
But of course, this process involves you actually sending your whole will to the witnesses so they can take their time, read the whole document, see exactly what you've got, who you're leaving your money to, et cetera, et cetera. And, I think that a lot of people who make wills don't want their witnesses to know all of that detail. They just want them to witness the will, witness the signature, and that's it. So I think it's another reason why I think it's not an attractive option. And of course, because at the start of the pandemic, of course, these rules weren't in place, that most solicitors firms worked out a way of doing it without needing to do it over conferencing, video conferencing. So actually the ways had already been found. You know, I witnessed a will over a car bonnet, I think, in someone's drive fairly early on. So, you know, a way had already been found through it, and actually it was a not great solution, unfortunately, but and probably too late.
I think we've had our first one come in, which has been done, witnessed over video conferencing.
Okay, oh, that's interesting.
yeah, I think, like you say, I think people are keeping it as last resort, and they have figured out workarounds before the actual legislation got changed. And it's currently, I think it's the 31st of January 2020 that obviously the change is ineffective. So it'll be interesting to see actually if it becomes permanent as such, or whether it is going to be something that they would just revert back to.
Yeah, and there continues to be talk of the sort of dispensing power, so the court being given a power, as exists in some other jurisdictions, to effectively dispense with the formalities of making a will. And I can certainly see the reasoning behind that. The press likes to report the sort of, you know, the extreme cases, you know, the unsent text message cases from Australia and things like that. But, you know, I certainly see cases in the disputes that I'm involved with where people, you know, have made very serious attempts to make a will and just for whatever reason haven't done it. And it does seem very unfair in those circumstances that the court have to, you know, the will can't be implemented, and then that, you know, that clients are then sort of thrown onto the horns of a potentially risky and costly dispute as a result. So I can certainly see the benefits of a dispensing power, but inevitably it's one of those things that would have to be tested, and, you know, the limits of it would ultimately have to be found.
Yeah, definitely. It takes me on nicely, actually. So what are you finding at the moment, or probably over the last 2 years before COVID as well, are the most common areas of disputes?
I think that most of the disputes that we deal with can ultimately be put into two categories, generally speaking. One is sibling rivalry, essentially. That's what they're about. They might not be actually about a sibling rival, but essentially that's what's at the cause of them. So essentially that's where one, you know, a child has been excluded or has been preferred over another, and that causes issues of some guise. And that could be via second families or whatever, but ultimately that's at the heart of it. I think the second one then is essentially people who, it's the sort of common law spouse type cases. So essentially it's claims by partners of people who've died, but where no provision has been made for them, either because they've died intestate without a will, or that they've died with a will, but it's just out of date. So those sorts of claims by cohabitees, where they've just been left in a situation where essentially they've been left with nothing under a will from someone who has been making potentially fairly significant financial provision for them in the years prior to their death. So those are probably the two big categories of disputes that we see, and I think we will continue to see.
Do you find that people who have been cohabiting for years and have been living together in that, I suppose, the myth of the common law spouse, do you think they expect that actually, due to that arrangement, that they are going to inherit when their loved one passes away?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that there is still a myth that, you know, if you've lived with someone for a certain amount of time, that your provision is kind of locked in and that provision will be made for you in some way. I think also as well, there's sometimes the thing as well I also find is that there's a sort of often it's a second, you know, the cohabitee might be a second relationship, so there might be children from an earlier relationship, and often what has happened is that the person who has died has essentially been like the mediator between the two. So, you know, everyone has kind of got on all right during that person's lifetime. So, you know, the person who has the testator speaks to their family and they say, well, you'll look after whoever it is, my new partner, whatever. And they say, yeah, of course we will. But then, of course, what happens is the person then dies. They're the sort of mediator in the whole thing, has they're gone, and it kind of all erupts and they escalate into full blown disputes, really. So I think it's a combination of either assuming that something is going to happen when it isn't, or trusting other family members to do the right thing, and then ultimately that doesn't happen for whatever reason, really.
What's your opinion on obviously a lot of individuals will leave substantial sums to charities, whether through legacies or through leaving part share of their ultimate estate. Do you think people are more likely to potentially challenge a will if there are large sums of money going to charity?
I think it's a factor. I think actually the one thing where we sometimes see it is in the context of financial abuse type cases. I think there's a sort of COVID aspect to this as well in terms of financial abuse. And I can maybe come on to that. But I think I've certainly seen cases where, because the family know that a will, the estate is being left to charity, that there is financial abuse during their lifetime to essentially, you know, on the basis that they, the family thinks, well, the charity will be grateful for whatever they get. And essentially it's sort of being used as a way of kind of righting a sort of perceived wrong. So I think it is definitely is a factor whether or not it makes claimants more willing to bring a claim. I'm not sure. I think ultimately, you know, charities have resources and ultimately, you know, most of the time will take a fairly commercial view on these sorts of claims. So I think it depends, and I think the views, different charities take different views on these things. Some are more aggressive than others, and some are more aware of the PR consequences than others. I think most of it is driven by the needs of the person bringing the claim. Are they in a situation where they need to bring a claim? And if they need to bring a claim, you know, then they probably will. The fact that there's a charity there, I'm not really sure that it makes a huge difference, and I think there are probably arguments both ways as to why the claim might be better or worse, really. I think
it's interesting. I know obviously there's been a lot in the press recently, obviously, about charities, their revenue has dropped in terms because of donations. They haven't been able to do so much fundraising, etc. So potentially, I suppose that might be something that will change over the next 12-24 months. You might see more stuff when charities are involved coming through.
Yeah, and I think certainly, you know, from the charities, we get for a number of charities, and certainly, you know, they have seen legacy, more interest in legacy giving as a result of the pandemic. And obviously, particularly those charities where there is a sort of health connection. So those hospices, you know, those sorts of organisations, people want to give money to charity. And I think actually, seeing people in need, etc., I think has probably raised awareness of that. And people are aware of that charities are under pressures because all of those other income streams have been massively impacted as a result of COVID. So I think there will be an increase in legacy giving, and certainly that's the prediction over the next few years. But I also think that with the inevitable, you know, financial pressures and, you know, the recession, which seems inevitable, that's going to follow, that will bring more claims because people will be increasingly reliant on inheritances. So we'll fight when that money doesn't come through.
Yeah, I think that is the thing. You're still going to have them being given, but it's whether, I suppose, families then are more unhappy or feel it's more unfair is going to be what's going to decide over the next 12-24 months, isn't it, really?
Exactly. I think that's right.
So how do you think, in your opinion, the industry is going to change over the next coming years off the back of potentially COVID, but also before we had COVID in, around and on the, and something that we were all dealing with on a daily basis?
Well, I think certainly in terms of how we work, then I think, you know, certainly from my perspective and you know, from most of the people in my team, you know, we're not going back to 5 days a week in the office. That's just not happening. You know, I think probably most people, I think, are in favour of kind of split, you know, 3-2 split between home and office. So I think that will fundamentally change how we operate. This hasn't just been a brief thing of 2-3 months of people working from home. This has now been a year, and habits have changed. And there are people in my firm who, if you'd asked them at the beginning, they'd have been dead set against home working, but now have been won round by it. So I think it will change. I think it will change how we use our office space. I think we will use our offices differently. Absolutely there's a place for offices and collaborative spaces and those spaces to meet with people and face-to-face contact. Those all things are all hugely important. But I think certainly for a lot of the work that lawyers do, that actually in terms of just doing the work, that actually a lot of the time I think people prefer to do that from home. So I think that will change how we work and how we work with clients. And certainly, for charity clients, for example, they were already fairly agile in terms of working, and a lot of them work remotely already. And I think it would just accentuate that. So with more and more legacy offices working in all sorts of different places from home, with probably spending very little time in the office, I would guess. So I think that will be a huge change for the industry.
Do you think individual clients' expectations are going to change, just not being able to potentially have that face-to-face meeting as and when they want it?
I think for us, a lot of what we've had, our client base has always been pretty broad in terms of geography, in terms of where people are. We have lots of clients that are in fairly close proximity to our offices. But often we will only ever see those clients. We might see them like once or twice physically. Most of the time, we'd work with them over, phone or Skype. I think it depends. I still think that there is still absolutely a place for face-to-face contact. And I think that is the one thing that we've had. I think it is harder to build those new relationships with clients when you're remote. I think, and of course now there are clients that we're acting for that I've never physically met in person. I've only ever seen them on a Zoom call. And I think it is harder to build rapport, to build relationship, to build trust where you've never met them physically. But I don't think that's the same as saying we would need to see them in person all the time. So I think it's a balance. I think lots of clients who were initially sceptical about working remotely have been converted and can see the huge benefits for it practically. And certainly for clients of ours that are obviously still working and have got other commitments, then absolutely it makes their life so much easier if they can just hop on a Zoom call with us at 6:00 on the evening and then catch up with us. It just works so much better for them than having to come in and see us. But I still think there'll be clients who want to see us face to face, probably less so than before, but I still think there'll be clients who want to see us.
And in terms of your workload, in terms of your makeup of your contentious estates that are coming in, what do you think your main reason is going to be for those contentious claims being made over the next sort of 5 years?
I think it's financial pressures. I think it's people who do or don't do certain things in the expectation of inheriting money from parents or whoever it is. Particularly when people are going to be under financial pressure, I just think that will ultimately drive a lot of disputes. I think the other thing is sibling rivalry. Sibling rivalry never goes away. As I said, it drives so many disputes that we deal with. And I think that there's no reason for that not to continue with sort of families that are becoming more divergent in terms of, children going off and doing different things all over the place. I just think that there's going to be more and more of those sorts of cases where, and particularly we're actually seeing it, particularly in the context of sort of family businesses as well. So where you've got, for example, one son who's working in a business and then a daughter or who isn't, that is often a huge tension, area of tension and generates lots of disputes because obviously the person, there's a desire to retain the business, but of course those who aren't in the business want their share of the estate. So those disputes are often very difficult to resolve. So I think we'll see more and more of those.
Do you think issue are relying on inheritance from their parents?
I certainly see a lot of cases where there is an assumption that people will inherit from their parents. So when they leave their estate to charity, to other family members, to friends or whatever, then I think that is a huge shock. And I think that shock factor is a huge issue in itself that does drive disputes. I think the surprise element is often the catalyst. You know, it's just a toxic combination where you've got the grief of someone having passed away, and then the shock of realizing that rather than inheriting, you know, their estate or a share of it, that it's suddenly being left to an animal charity or whoever it is. And it's just it's a toxic conversation. And it's a bit of a, I often find that it's an easy thing to focus on the rather than sort of tackle the grief of dealing with the fact that your parents might have passed away, that actually focusing on the dispute and having going to war with your brother or sister is actually an easier focus. So you see it in cases when once those cases have settled, the kind of emotion kind of hits the client like a kind of wave, because essentially it's just kind of displacement. So I think that surprise is a huge, and again, advice that I always give to people who are making wills is talk to your family about them first, because it's the element of surprise that causes so many issues.
I was going to say, from your experience, are you finding out that people are either finding out when a grant's been issued and the will's a public document, or someone is telling them from the point that their loved one's passed away?
Yeah, exactly. The sort of, the idea of the reading of the will, which people still like the idea of, although it never really happens, is anywhere near in exciting ways it does in the films. But yeah, absolutely, it's that element of surprise. It's finding out, you know, the solicitor writes to them and it says, oh yeah, you're not in the will. And it's like, what? And it just, it can kick off big time.
And in terms of change, in terms of estate administration as a whole, and obviously your area of speciality, the contentious side, what predictions can you see coming up in the legal sector?
Well, I think we will. I think we talked briefly about the change to the law around wills. I think that there is some pressure to make some changes, and I think, I think personally that there is some merit in this dispensing power that allows the court to dispense with the formalities of wills. Beyond that, I think that probably we'll see charities probably take I think they will be more willing to fight for some of their legacies that they get. And I think that's there's probably two reasons for that. I think the first is that they're under huge financial pressures to do so. Legacy income has been relatively steady during the pandemic, and indeed a lot of charities are actually seeing it on the rise. So it's really much seen as a kind of keeping the lights on at the moment in terms of a lot of charities. So I think there'll be some financial pressures on charities to continue to, you know, fight those cases. Now, fight doesn't mean take it to trial, and I still don't think most charities are hugely cautious about taking cases to trial, but I think that we will see them take perhaps a sort of more robust line than they might have done before. So I think that will happen. I also think that there'll continue to be a huge focus on resolving disputes outside the court process. Litigation just gets more and more expensive, and you know the rules are changing all the time, and you know it's becoming an even more expensive process. A lot of the costs are being front loaded, so I think the pressure to do things like mediation, I think, will increase. And it is such a good way of resolving these family disputes, and it works so very well that I think we'll continue to see that grow, with more and more disputes being resolved in that way.
And I know you mentioned earlier about a lot of obviously the hearings and the mediation all have gone online, obviously able to do it remotely. Do you think that will continue, or once we can get back to a bit of normality, we'll start reverting to the old ways?
I think we'll continue with both. I think for the hearings, we'll continue to have a sort of, there'll be a hybrid approach where some hearings that work, you know, where essentially you've just got, you know, two barristers speaking, they can continue to take place remotely, and that works incredibly well for clients, for barristers, for solicitors. Those work incredibly well. And, you know, inevitably for court hearings where you've got witnesses giving evidence, then I think that those are bound to go back to, you know, kind of the old, you know, sort of the older in-person ways. So I think it'll be a hybrid. I think people will try and, you know, get the best of both worlds, really. And I think the same goes for mediations. You know, we've got lots of cases where you've got solicitors and clients all over the country, and all, in fact, beyond that, all over the world. So remote mediations works incredibly well. I think, though, again, what you might see is solicitors, you know, so rather than everyone being on a separate Zoom call, that actually you might have, you know, I might be in the office with my client, and then the other side, they'll be in their solicitor's office, which could be anywhere in the country, with their client, and then the mediator will be somewhere else. So we will all be on a Zoom call, but I might be physically with my client in a room. And I think those sorts of hybrid situations, I think, are probably more likely. I certainly don't think they're gone away. I think most, you know, I think all, well, I'd guess that all solicitors doing what I do have all seen the benefits of it. So I think it would just be a case of picking and choosing the bits that work well and the bits that perhaps are still best done in person, really.
Yeah, and I think you're right. It's about giving the clients that flexibility now, isn't it? And those practices and people that haven't been so keen before, COVID has made people actually think of what they want to do and the best ways of doing it forward. So that has been probably beneficial to the industry and brought around change sooner than it would otherwise, I suspect.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I agree. Absolutely.
Well, it's been really great to speak to you today about all these topics. And I think, yeah, it has clearly highlighted that there has been a lot of change over the last 12 months. And there's probably a lot more change to come, especially off the back of COVID and how the makeup of work's going to come to you in line with perhaps the looking at wills and how documents are now being executed. And also just the general contentious, I mean, what I read, and I'm no contentious expert, you can see that contentious cases are increasing, and I can't see that changing over the upcoming couple of years, to be honest.
No, I think that's right. I think that's right. It's definitely a growth area at the moment, and I think that it will continue to grow, and it will continue to grow quickly, I think.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
No problem at all. Thank you for your time.